From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Hope you enjoyed the long weekend and hope that your shortened work week is getting off to a great start. All right, coming up on today's show, more storms are on the way this week, and that's prompting worry that floodgates at the Whittier Narrows Dam in Pico Rivera could fail if a large storm sends too much water down the San Gabriel River. We'll find out what L.A. County plans to do about it. Plus, preserving indigenous murals in Northeast L.A.
A lot of these murals are now part of Los Angeles's history. They tell us about a time period that has passed, and they do so in public space that's constantly shifting and changing all the time.
We visit a mural in Highland Park that's being restored after years of tagging. First, though, there are more than 7,000 minors in L.A. County's juvenile justice system. For those in juvenile hall, though, a recent inspector general's report shows that there's a spike in the use of pepper spray to subdue and sometimes intimidate detainees. Now, that got the attention of L.A. County supervisors who are meeting today, right now, in fact. Some of them are pushing to phase out pepper spray altogether, and one of them is Supervisor Sheila Kuhl. Earlier today, Kuhl told me she was shocked at the way pepper spray has been used.
What we've heard from the inspector general is that there have been several instances where they did not do the cleanup right away, where they didn't provide the water, where they put the kid in a room and let them suffer. I mean, it is so painful. You can get blistering. You lose your sight for a while. And they've even been sprayed, you know, in intimate places. And it's just horrible. Just the use of it alone is egregious. And it just started to look cumulative in terms of how much more often the probation officers were using pepper spray. For a while, we had an agreement with the federal government that we weren't going to use it except in very, very extreme circumstances. And that memorandum of agreement terminated.
The termination of that agreement, is that seen as the reason or maybe the driving factor why there has been an increase? 150% between 2015 and 2017, the use of pepper spray?
Well, I don't know whether anyone's really put their finger on the reason. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is we have far fewer young people in our camps and facilities these days than we used to. And what we've heard from the probation officers is that means that the young people that are in the camps are more prone to violence, there's more gang stuff, et cetera. And I guess they feel that they have to use something in order to, you know, defuse these situations. But we're saying not this.
If officers don't use pepper spray to control an outburst, what's the better alternative?
We want de-escalation techniques. We want better training for the probation officers. We want, you know, different ways to separate the young people from each other. California is one of only 15 states that still uses pepper spray. Everybody is learning that this is just not the right way to exert control.
What do experts say about any kind of pepper spray use being acceptable? Is there a level that you've heard from experts?
Experts generally say that there are physical and psychological results from using this pepper spray on young people, and that if it must be used, they recommend that the probation officers do not carry it with them, that it's locked up, so they have to take a second and third thought before they go and get it. That there have to be immediate steps taken to get this stuff out of the eyes and off the face of these young people. So I have to say, I'm over it. I think we just need to do away with it.
We're talking to L.A. County Supervisor Sheila Kuhl. The county's inspector general also found that probation officers aren't getting adequate training on when to use it. Some shook canisters or issued threats about using it, for example, just to gain control of a situation. Supervisor, why consider banning pepper spray when the county maybe could invest in more officer training and oversight?
We want to invest more in officer training and oversight because we want de-escalation techniques. We want better use of talk and other kinds of ways to keep the young people from fighting each other. The other thing, though, is that pepper spray, in my opinion, is never an appropriate tool. So banning it is the right thing to do, in addition to adding more training about other ways in which to de-escalate and control a situation.
Now, the report also details some other disturbing practices in juvenile halls, like detainees being denied access to toilets and sinks, so they have to use things like trash cans. Supervisor, is pepper spray maybe here a scapegoat for bigger problems inside the county's juvenile halls?
I don't think so, actually. The vast majority of our probation officers on custody duty are doing a great job. I think we have to single out those people who do the wrong thing, like anyone who obviously denies our young people the ability to go to the bathroom. But I don't think pepper spray is a surrogate for bad behavior. I think it's something that needs to be done away with as a tool and then deal across the board with behavior that is unacceptable.
Now, at today's meeting, you'll consider phasing out the use of pepper spray. What are the next steps, Supervisor?
If the motion passes today, then we have asked for pepper spray to be phased out by the end of the year. I think it's a pretty heavy lift, really, for them to do all the training that needs to be done for other kinds of techniques. But I thought if we didn't set a deadline, you know, we wouldn't get to it. Mark Ridley-Thomas has also asked that there be a public hearing about it, which I think will help bolster the reasons why we did this. So next steps are really follow this motion if it passes and do the training and get rid of pepper spray.
That's Los Angeles County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, staying with juvenile discipline, California's Division of Juvenile Justice has a culture of, quote, pervasive violence and isolation. Now, that's according to a new report from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. It found that the problems at state-run juvenile facilities could impact the health of young people in prison and their ability to succeed after they're released. Renee Menart is a communications and policy analyst at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. She worked on the report and joins us for more. Renee, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with a little background. In 2004, something called the Farrell lawsuit led to plans for improving California's Division of Juvenile Justice. How did that case affect conditions for incarcerated kids?
So when the Farrell lawsuit came about, it put the facilities under greater monitoring during the 12-year-long lawsuit. But then in 2016, when that ended, the court monitoring ended as well. And so what our new report looks at and finds is that the facilities remain dangerous and not rehabilitative for young people.
Yeah, this doesn't sound like a great picture being painted here, Renee. Why is this happening? Why has it been 12 years and or more than 12 years and nothing seems to be getting better?
Well, you know, a number of factors continue to be at play. DJJ operates facilities that are in remote locations in California. These are large prison-like facilities in remote areas of the state. When you look at the population of youth at DJJ, the majority of them are coming from urban areas and coming from areas that are over 100 miles away from home. So that puts youth at far distances away from their families and their communities and creates major barriers for them when maintaining and building a support system.
And Renee, you said you mentioned the conditions of some of these facilities. You got to tour them. You got to look at them firsthand. What did you see?
As part of this report, we toured DJJ's three program facilities. So two of those are in Stockton and one of those is in Ventura. And when you walk into these facilities, even as an adult, you feel the impact the moment you walk in. You feel the prison-like conditions that are there. So, for example, walking into a living unit, youth were generally in their cells, sitting on their beds. You know, there was a real just heaviness to the entire experience, and that was apparent at all of the facilities.
So, in other words, they're not doing anything to get them to a point where they can come back to everyone else in society. They're just kind of waiting out their time just like any other inmate in any adult prison.
Yeah, you know, the rehabilitative programs that DJJ touts really are lacking. So not only on the tours, but in the conversations we had with young people around this report, we heard a lot about the major issues with their education and their programming opportunities. The therapeutic oriented programming that there is run by correctional staff. So you have groups being led by the person who is guards and disciplines the facilities. And the majority of youth talked about having large amounts of idle time, either in their cells or in their units, that ultimately left them feeling very unprepared for their release.
Talking to Renee Menart, communications and policy analyst at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. All right, so Renee, the conditions aren't so great. A lot of these kids are isolated from where they're from. The locations themselves are isolated from a lot of other things in their area. What does this do for the kids? How prepared are these kids to return to normal life?
Each of the young people that we spoke with around this report spoke so much about the hopes they had, and they expressed a real sense of anxiety, a sense of isolation, even when they return home. And those are major barriers for young people. And it's those experiences of young people that I think often get lost when we, you know, look at an institution where violence is normalized and where extreme cases of violence seem to be a part of the day-to-day, we also sometimes fail to recognize just how impactful and pervasive the culture of these institutions are for when youth return home.
Well, let's get into that culture a bit, because that's something else you highlight. A rise in riots and staff use of force at these facilities since the end of the Farrell lawsuit. Now, while that obviously puts kids' physical safety in jeopardy, what does this do for them mentally and emotionally when they eventually get to go home?
You know, every young person that was interviewed as part of this report was able to describe an experience in which either they themselves experienced violence at the hands of a staff member or another youth in the facility, or an experience in which they witnessed that. And, you know, the young people that we spoke with really describe the ongoing impacts of the violence that they experienced and witnessed at DJJ facilities, impacting their mental health on their return home. So some of the young people we spoke with are experiencing extreme anxiety, some insomnia. And so the violence that they experience has major implications to their day-to-day life, both within the facilities and outside of it.
Now, for this report, you also spoke to staff at these juvenile facilities. So what did they have to say about what was going on?
That's right. Well, you know, the staff that we spoke with painted a similar picture with their experiences. One of the things that stands out most is this real code of silence that exists among staff members based off of those we spoke with. They discussed feeling like they, you know, weren't really able to speak out about abuses or issues among staff members because of a strong culture between staff that pushes them to keep quiet and to keep their head down.
This report, Renee, highlights a lot of concerns. What needs to happen to start turning these things around a bit?
At the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, we recognize the future of juvenile justice in California really is at the local level. And we're at a key point in time right now where Governor Gavin Newsom has put a focus on the Division of Juvenile Justice. And we've been very encouraged by his recognition that youth need trauma-informed rehabilitative approaches to support them, and that DJJ is currently failing to provide that.
Renee Menart is a communications and policy analyst with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. She's been talking with us about its new report on conditions within California's juvenile justice facilities. Renee, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Remember last week when President Trump declared the national emergency? He predicted it would be challenged in court, specifically the Ninth Circuit Court. Well, he was right. California, along with 15 other states, did just that right where he said they would, the Ninth Circuit. But have you ever wondered why many of those legal challenges to the Trump administration start there? The answer is coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. When President Trump unveiled his plan to declare a national emergency to secure funds for a border wall, he predicted that legal challenges would follow. It took just 3 days. On Monday, 16 states, with California in the lead, filed a complaint to block that move. This morning, President Trump responded on Twitter saying that the suit was filed, of course, in the Ninth Circuit. The San Francisco-based court does have a history with the president. It's blocked two versions of the president's travel ban, upheld an order to keep the DACA program in place, and put efforts to restrict asylum applications at the southern border on hold. So what is it about the Ninth Circuit that makes it a popular choice for lawsuits against the administration? Let's get more from Andrew Brott. He's a professor of law at UC Berkeley. Thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here.
All right. Last week, when President Trump announced his intention to declare a national emergency, he also said this.
And we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit. even though it shouldn't be there. And we will possibly get a bad ruling.
Kind of a musical cadence there. But, Andrew, why was it so predictable to President Trump that he would face a legal challenge in the Ninth Circuit?
Well, the Ninth Circuit is perceived, although the perception is really more than reality, as the most liberal of the courts of appeals in the United States. And it was predictable, I think, that there would be a lawsuit probably from the state of California against President Trump. And of course, California is in the Ninth Circuit. And so it was entirely predictable that he would face multiple lawsuits, but at least one of them would be in the Ninth Circuit.
Now, you said the Ninth Circuit is perceived to be the most liberal. Is it the most liberal?
It may be, although the fact of the matter is that most measures show it as not that much more liberal than many of the other circuit courts. It has a reputation for being the most liberal because President Carter had the opportunity to really pack the court in the 1970s with some of the most liberal judges really in the country. But in the intervening period, conservative presidents have also been able to appoint judges to the Ninth Circuit. And so while the circuit has retained its reputation for being extremely liberal, it's actually not, that doesn't match the reality.
And how much of it has to do with its plain location? California, Oregon judges drawn from these communities as well?
Yeah, I think quite a lot. I mean, even in the days when you had senators from those states having a lot of control over what judges would get appointed, of course, we're talking about some very blue states here, California, typically Washington, Oregon, Hawaii. Those judges drawn from those communities would tend to be more liberal than, say, other parts of the country.
Talking to Andrew Brott, he's a professor of law at UC Berkeley. Now, it's interesting, Andrew, because for issues such as the travel ban or this particular emergency declaration, there are issues that affect the entire nation. But in the legal world, it's not exactly uncommon for lawyers to shop around for a potentially more friendly court, is it? Is that, that's kind of how it works, isn't it?
Oh, that's absolutely the case. I mean, that's true in cases like this one that are of nationwide importance, but also of cases that are just of importance to those who are litigating them, like a car accident. The plaintiff always gets to choose the forum, and the plaintiff is always going to choose the forum that it thinks is going to be most friendly to it, whether it's because of the judges or the jury pool or what have you. And so it's not at all uncommon. In fact, it's expected that lawyers are going to choose the forum that they think is going to be most friendly. Now, that's always speculative and it's always a prediction game, but that's certainly something that lawyers always do.
Because I was about to say that, Andrew, then if you have a case that maybe would be better for you if they had more liberal judges, then you'd look for a more liberal court. Isn't that where the perception really exists, why people think it's more liberal than any other court in the nation?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a little bit where the reputation then draws cases to the Ninth Circuit, and then things go from there. But lawyers are always looking for whatever advantage they can find, including what they think will be the friendliest court.
Now, to be clear, conservatives do this too, right? In the United States, it's not like it's just the Ninth Circuit thing.
Everybody does this. You'll remember when President Obama tried to engage in executive action to protect the Dreamers. Conservative lawyers did this by filing lawsuits against him in Texas, which is in the far more conservative Fifth Circuit. So this is not at all a thing that only liberal lawyers do. This is very much a bipartisan activity.
Now, it's worth mentioning that even though historically it takes a while for a case to work its way through the Ninth Circuit, this particular legal challenge over the National Emergency Declaration will probably go a lot faster. Why is that, Andrew?
That's because this case is one that's looking for an injunction, that is, an order against the president from engaging in this action. And all cases that seek an injunction, particularly a preliminary injunction, are immediately appealable to the courts of appeals. So this case is likely to be fast-tracked to the Ninth Circuit, and I would imagine would then be fast-tracked to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And then that's where President Trump, who has appointed two conservative judges, kind of gets his day in the sun then. That's what it would seem like.
Well, that's what it seems like. He may even get his day in the sun earlier because one of the areas where President Trump has been extraordinarily successful has been appointing judges not just to the U.S. Supreme Court, but to the courts of appeals and the lower courts, including the Ninth Circuit. One of President Trump's great legacies is going to be perhaps eliminating the Ninth Circuit's reputation as being among the most liberal.
Now, the president is definitely not the first person to criticize the Ninth Circuit. Conservatives have called it too big, too liberal. liberal. Some have suggested even splitting the court. Former Congressman Daryl Issa was one. Andrew, is there a genuine case to be made for splitting up the Ninth Circuit, or are the political motivations pretty clear here?
Well, one could make a good faith argument for splitting the Ninth Circuit. It's by far the largest. There are 29 active judges on the Ninth Circuit. It covers about 64 million people, which is almost twice as large as any other circuit. But the reality here is that the arguments for breaking up the Ninth Circuit are really almost exclusively politically motivated. They almost always come from, well, they do always come from conservatives who think the Ninth Circuit is too liberal and want to dilute its power. So while one could make a plausible argument for breaking up the circuit, the reality is that this is a power grab move.
Andrew Broad is a professor of law at UC Berkeley. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Staying with politics, when troubled U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke left office, his deputy David Bernhardt stepped in. Then earlier this month, President Trump tweeted that he'll nominate Bernhardt to officially take over the department. But if he gets the job, his presence could complicate an environmental battle being waged right here in California. New York Times environment reporter Coral Davenport has a story. She joins us now. Coral, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Okay, David Bernhardt is a former lobbyist, and California farmers were among his clients. Now that takes us to Northern California. Coral, what was Bernhardt doing there for farmers?
Bernhardt was a lobbyist for a group of farmers, the Westlands Water District. It's a group of about 700 farmers, not really family farmers. This is kind of big agribusiness. He lobbied for them between 2011 and 2016, specifically to weaken Endangered Species Act protections on two fish, the Delta smelt and the winter run Chinook salmon. If those protections on those fish are lifted, that is a huge step towards freeing up the water in the San Francisco Bay Delta for irrigation for farmers. The farmers are desperate for that water. They're suffering under multiple years of drought. And it's these Endangered Species Act protections that really stand between the farmers and the water.
And Coral, remind us why environmentalists say protection of the Delta smelt is so important.
The reason it's important is that if you lift these protections on these fish, the levels of the water in the San Francisco Bay Delta could go down so low, it could threaten a much broader ecosystem. And the biggest results that could happen are, one, the growth of toxic algal blooms. I talked to one biologist who said, when you have those toxic algal blooms growing in the water, dogs that jump into that water don't jump out.
Wow.
You also end up damaging the food chain that goes from the teeny little smelt that most people don't care about up to salmon, which commercial fishermen definitely care about, up to seals, up to the orca whale. The same biologist said, if you do this and you damage the food chain, it's not a maybe. You will see starving orca whales.
All right. Now Bernhardt is in the government. He's playing a different role in that fight over the area. What's he doing now?
Bernhardt is the deputy secretary of the Interior Department, the number two. And in that role, he has taken a very hands-on role inside the Interior Department, essentially doing from the inside what he was lobbying the federal government to do as a lobbyist. He's working on a plan. He has directed officials underneath him to get started on their process of weakening those Endangered Species Act protections.
And the Trump administration earlier this month proposed a relaxing regulations on how water is shared between the fish and the farmers in the Central Valley. So really, he's doing what the president wants and actually campaigned on, right?
Yes. In 2016, he met with these same farmers and he said, this is ridiculous, essentially, that, you know, your water has to be held up because of this little 3-inch fish. We're going to do everything we can to make sure you get this water. So this is a Trump priority. And this is also exactly what David Bernhardt tried to do on behalf of his client. The problem is, because he was doing this exact working for this exact policy as a lobbyist, right up until before he was confirmed to enter the federal government, and now he's working on the same policy on the inside, it looks like it could be violating federal ethics rules.
We're speaking to Coral Davenport. She covers energy and the environment for the New York Times. Now, those ethics experts you spoke about, they told you it's a conflict of interest, but what has the Interior Department said about all this?
So the Interior Department has its own ethics lawyers. And Bernhardt, I interviewed him about this, and he said that he talked to them before he got involved in a hands-on way. They gave a kind of a verbal approval. However, a lot of ethics experts who I talked to who have worked in various administrations, Republican and Democrat, say that really is not enough. For a case like this, where someone lobbied directly on this issue right up until they entered the federal government, and then immediately, less than a year, began working on the same issue. That's kind of a textbook violation of federal ethics rules and even the Trump ethics pledge. Bernhardt is saying, you know, well, this policy is huge. It affects the whole Central Valley region, but it doesn't affect all the farmers and all the recipients of the water the same. Westlands would be a disproportionate winner in this policy. You know, I did not talk to a single expert outside of the government, many of whom have worked on this, who said it looks like this complies with the law. And they also said it's a big problem that it's an appearance of a conflict of interest.
And David Bernhardt, for his part, says that these ethical questions are important for him to address and that he feels he's kind of dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's on this.
He did. I interviewed him and he said that his wife is an ethics lawyer with the Justice Department. I believe that he really does believe these things are important to him, but it still looks like, if nothing else, there's a very clear appearance conflict of interest.
Did California's farmers have any qualms about Bernhardt helping him out this way?
Well, now that the policy is being changed to free up their water for them, and the water could flow as soon as this December, they're delighted.
What have California's environmentalists said about what they expect from Bernhardt if he's confirmed to lead the U.S. Interior Department?
If confirmed, he is seen as someone who would be very, very effective in getting the Trump administration agenda of opening up land, getting offshore drilling in place, lifting protections on public lands, really getting that done, and probably getting it potentially to legally stick as well and getting it done quickly.
Finally, what's the timeline for David Bernhardt's possible confirmation?
He would have to have a confirmation hearing at the Senate Energy Committee that has not even been scheduled yet. That presumably is expected to happen sometime in the next couple of weeks. After the hearing, then he would have to be voted through that Senate committee, and then the vote for confirmation would come up on the Senate floor. So it's at least a few weeks, maybe a month, maybe a little more than that. We've already seen some Democratic senators saying that they will vote against him. But unless we see a large number of Republican senators saying they oppose him, his confirmation at this point still seems assured.
Coral Davenport covers the environment and energy for the New York Times. Coral, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. If you find yourself looking at the moon tonight, and it seems just a bit more luminous, no, it's not all in your head. It will be a super snow moon, which means it'll be the biggest and brightest the entire year. What makes it so super is that the full moon will be closest in its orbit to Earth, making it appear bigger than normal. What makes it a snow moon is that centuries ago, Native Americans and Europeans named full moons for the weather most associated with the time of the year when they occurred. And in February, that is snow. Technically, the super snow moon reached its peak earlier this morning, but it wasn't visible then. The best time to catch it will be tonight, just as the moon begins to rise, because that's when it'll be closest to the horizon. In Southern California, moonrise will be at 6:02 this evening, so when the clock strikes 6 tonight, go outside and just look up. But if you missed tonight's super moon, the third and final one of the year will take place next month, March 19th. Everybody was dancing in the moonlight, dancing in the moonlight. Everybody's feeling warm and bright. It's such a— All right, there's a chance we're going to get some more rain this week. I mean, it's been glorious around L.A. with so much green growth all over the place. My backyard actually isn't brown and dusty as it usually is. There's some grass on it right now. Now, that's one of the positives. One of the downsides is flooding. Come up, find out why the county of L.A. wants to have more water flow control. That's ahead when Take 2 continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Officials have known for a long time that floodgates at the Whittier Narrows Dam in Pico Rivera could fail in a large storm that sends a lot of water down the San Gabriel River. The dam's owner, the Army Corps of Engineers, has a $600 million plan to fix the problem, but now Los Angeles County Public Works, which runs a network of dams upstream from the one at Whittier Narrows, wants to take over the federally owned land along the dam's nearby channels. That move would put the county more fully in control of the water flow on the river from its mountain origins to its outlet on the Pacific Ocean. Here to help us understand the risk to downstream communities is KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNary. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there.
All right, so let's start with the Whittier Narrows Dam. Where is it? What does it do? And why is it on our minds today?
Okay, so the San Gabriel River, it comes out of the San Gabriel Mountains around Duarte and Azusa, and it runs south in kind of like this wide channel until you get to the Whittier Narrows in Pico Rivera. So picture the Narrows. It's a natural gap in the hills that form the southern boundary of the San Gabriel Valley. So the Rio Hondo River and the San Gabriel River flow through this gap and the Whittier Narrows Dam. So I go there when I'm riding my bike along the San Gabriel River. Sure. They've got a beautiful path down there. So the dam itself is kind of this 3-mile-long gigantic berm. And it's not that high as dams go. It's just 56 feet tall from the foundation to the top. And it controls the water flow in the San Gabriel and Rio Hondo rivers. So it was built in 1957 by the Army Corps of Engineers. And like most of their dams in Southern California, it's dry most of the year. But it's in the news right now because the Corps and some local cities have been trying to raise local awareness about the risk the dam poses to homes and lives in the very remote event that the dam would fail.
Okay, so what's wrong with the dam?
Yeah. There's three issues that could become disastrous after weeks and weeks of big rain. So first off, the dam's built on a sandy swale foundation. Back in 1957, when the dam was built, that wasn't seen to be a big problem for dams that stay dry most of the year. But if the dam sits next to pooled water for a long time, the foundation can erode. That actually happened in 1983, but then the pool of water was drawn down before it became a significant issue. The second problem is that if the dam got so much water that it overtops the crest of that dam, the force of the water could deteriorate and scour out the downstream face of the dam. So that could have the effect of lowering the crest of the dam and letting even more water go downstream uncontrolled. Third, if the dam were to receive weeks and weeks of heavy rain, or if like one of the upstream dams were to suddenly release its load of water, the gates on the dam could malfunction. They could open prematurely, sending all that water downstream into the concrete channel of the San Gabriel River. But the channel isn't wide or deep enough to safely direct all that water to the ocean. The overflow would fill up Pico Rivera like a bucket, and the main routes out of that city all cross the river. So the potential that people could be trapped by floodwaters is the concern. There would also be flooding along the river from Pico Rivera to Long Beach in places where it overflows the channel sides. So disaster planners call these kinds of scenarios low probability but high consequence, meaning the chance of a megastorm flood causing a dam failure is pretty low, but a lot of people could die if it does.
Yeah, that sounds all kinds of horrific though, Sharon. Yeah. So okay, but you say the failure of the Whittier Narrows Dam is a low probability, high consequence event. Let's break that down. Why is failure low probability?
It's a low probability because it would come in the event of a super rain, the sort of storm that we have only a 1 in 900 chance of getting every year. There was a series of storms like that in 1862 in LA area, so it's not unheard of. But, you know, like that atmospheric river that's moved the bands of moisture from the equator up to California, that's one element that could feed a series of big rains. And climate change is expected to bring not only drought during dry times, but more drastic heavy rainstorms when we do get rain. So each year, there's a 1 in 900 odds of getting enough rain to cause this kind of a problem.
Okay, that's the probability. What about the consequences? You say they could be pretty high.
Very high. About 1 million people live in the footprint of the potential flood area. And so for some of those areas, evacuation plans are only recently formed. The Army Corps had declared some concerns about the dam in 2008, but it assigned the Whittier Narrows Dam its worst rating in 2016. It said the combination of life or economic consequences with the likelihood of failure was very high. When I first wrote about this problem in 2017, the city of Pico Rivera had only just started an internal dialogue about its plans to alert and evacuate residents in such a disaster. And some cities downstream from that all had no plans in the works at all.
No plans. All right. So what's the plan then to increase awareness of the flood risk and reduce the risk itself?
As far as the dam goes, the Army Corps has a $600 million plan to fix the Whittier Narrows Dam. There's been a recent series of meetings by the Army Corps of Engineers with residents in Pico Rivera and some other places to take public input on their plan to repair the dam. And LA County has attended various tabletop drills where the Army Corps and local stakeholders like the cities go through these various emergency scenarios, like a mega storm that overtops a dam or a big earthquake breaking the dam. So local preparation has improved somewhat. Meanwhile, LA County wants to take ownership from the federal government of about 40 miles of land alongside channels leading to and from four Army Corps dams, including the Whittier Narrows Dam.
Why does the county want to do that?
I spoke with Dan Lafferty, deputy director of the LA County Flood Control, this morning. He says the federal government spends about $20 million a year maintaining areas that really need about 10 times that amount to clear trash and do all the things the public is asking for, like making the areas more recreational, cleaning up the trash, better landscaping. Also, the county has two new sources of money. One is for dealing with a homeless population along the river, and the second is for increasing the amount of storm runoff that could be captured before it's lost to the ocean. The county argues that transferring ownership of the land could take the burden off federal hands and make maintenance of the San Gabriel and the LA and other rivers far more uniform, with services provided faster and with less federal red tape. And of course, to get to that point is itself a lot of red tape. A study on the transfer won't even occur for at least another year. And we know that County Supervisor Hilda Solis is expected to introduce some kind of motion regarding the Whittier Narrows Dam in March. But as far as the Whittier Narrows Dam itself is concerned, it's a hot potato. The county doesn't want to touch it until the federal government gets it all repaired.
All right, that's KPCC's infrastructure reporter, Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, turning now to public art. A few things capture working-class Latinos' anxiety over gentrification, like the images of indigenous people fading from existence, specifically the murals in Highland Park and other parts of Northeast L.A. But one classic mural next to the Southwest Museum on Marmion Way is being repainted after being buffed out or whitewashed a few years ago. Reporters Chris Greenspun and Philip Iglauer bring us this story about the significance of restoring and preserving murals in Northeast L.A.
Daniel Cervantes is shading in a Liberty Bell on his client's arm at Blackbird Tattoo in Covina. Cervantes and his family bought a home there in 2016 after being priced out of Highland Park, where he grew up in the 80s and 90s. His interests back then? Skateboarding and graffiti. His favorite places to do it?
Trains, rivers, buses.
Eventually, Cervantes turned his spray can to legit muralism that fused together his interests in Chicano studies and political graffiti. In 2003, the Southwest Museum commissioned him to paint a 169-foot montage of indigenous tribes on Marmion Way downhill from the museum, including the Tongva, Pueblo, and Chickasaw.
At the time when I grew up, like, Highland Park had a lot of gang violence and stuff, and I always felt that learning your culture would kind of bring some sort of unity towards the community, you know, that there was too much lack of knowledge of who we were, where we came from, and what happened in history.
But it didn't last. Over time, due to neglect, the mural became a graffiti canvas. Much like how some working-class Latino residents have been feeling displaced in Northeast LA recently, the mural was covered with cream-colored paint, or whitewashed, in 2013.
I knew it was going to happen. I know what area I lived in, you know, and I hope that at least maybe some kids that were into graffiti or some sort of art got to see it, and hopefully they got inspired the way I got inspired through all the cool stuff I seen in L.A., you know?
There are all kinds of murals in Highland Park, El Sereno, and other parts of Northeast L.A. that pay tribute to indigenous history before and after European colonization. They color the sides of businesses and barrier walls and electricity boxes. And while some of them remain untouched by taggers who've heeded calls to please respect, others haven't been so lucky. Although there are efforts to preserve these indigenous images, which have been a major theme in Chicano art since the 70s.
There was a caste system, a sort of racial hierarchy that was developed throughout Latin America, with whites at the top and then going down through to Native folks and brown folks.
Aaron Curtis co-authored the book Murales Rebeldes with Jessica Huff and Gisela Latorre. She says many Chicano muralists identify with indigenous iconography. Some trace their roots back to the native populations that lived in the Americas when the Spanish invaded Mexico in 1519 and created the mixed-race mestizo class.
this mixed identity is very common, that's the result of colonization, and that different people connect to it in different ways. It's very, very individualized.
And this sort of cultural mixing lives on. Pola Lopez is a Chicana artist who moved to Northeast LA from New Mexico in 2003. Her painting career took more of a gallery and museum track. At the time, there was no official registration process for murals.
When it was illegal, you could just go up and do a wall, you know, and nobody said anything. You took your chances.
But that changed in 2013 when the city created the registration ordinance for murals, whether they were old or new.
Now, because of the money involved, you know, because there are grants and people are funding them, then you have to answer to, you know, they're commissioned pieces.
And this is where the art of Pola Lopez and Daniel Cervantes connect. Based on her work painting murals in the juvenile justice system, as well as her past residence at Highland Park's Avenue 50 studio, last year, Lopez was selected to repaint Cervantes' mural. She'll submit her drawings at the end of the month and hopes to get started on it in March. And Cervantes has given her his blessing to restore it. Unlike the graffiti he did in his youth, he says murals have the potential to reach people of all ages, providing Latinos with a meditation on who they are and where they come from. Here's mural historian Aaron Curtis again.
A lot of these murals are now part of Los Angeles's history. They tell us about a time period that has passed, and they do so in public space that's constantly shifting and changing all the time. So it's really important to protect and restore murals like this because they are one of the most direct and public links to our shared history here in Los Angeles.
The repainting of Cervantes' Chicano mural brings back a message of ancestral pride. One originally painted by a Highland Park native beneath one of the city's major repositories of Native American artifacts. For Take Two, I'm Chris Greenspan, reporting with Philip Iglauer.
Hiking in Southern California seems like an easy thing, right? Well, it can be as long as you're prepared, especially if you've been thinking about taking advantage of the cool weather. Coming up, how to make the trails a fun and safe place to get exercise. That's ahead when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. Over the weekend, a trail runner fell over 150 feet to his death on Mount Wilson when he slipped on a patch of ice. This cold weather is expected to continue through the week, so if you're thinking about doing some hiking, we hope you do it safely. And for that reason, we're revisiting a conversation about hiking safety. It's with Mike Bloom, a trail safety expert and the search and rescue group leader for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He told us what precautions to take before hitting the trails.
Before you go, it's always good to read reviews. And you'll get a good idea about how difficult the trail is that way. But the bottom line is, if you're hiking along and you come across some snow and you don't have an ice axe and you don't have crampons, turn around.
Turn around, really? So no matter what, don't even try it. If at all you feel like you don't have the equipment either in your hand or in your body to handle that trail.
Exactly. And some people have it inside their pack and they think that's enough. Well, if you're not using it, it's not going to help you.
Why do people still, do you think, still decide to try things? I mean, I reasonable people might still try really dumb things out on the trails.
Well, I have to admit that 95% of who we go looking for are men out by themselves.
Wow.
So that's a big problem, going out hiking by yourself, because if someone's with you, then they could, you know, assist you if you get hurt or go for help.
Should you have a cell phone charge no matter what? We got to the point where you need to have that. Is that as important of a tool as anything else?
Actually, technology has greatly influenced our business, and cell phones have been a very big part of that. Because of the increased coverage areas that we have, we're able to send our subjects a text message from a search and rescue app. All they have to do is click on it, and we will get their exact location GPS coordinates. Mm. And we find about 20% of our missing persons based on the cell phone technology.
All right, so if you know where you're going, you should tell people, right? That seems so simple, but I think we all go out sometimes and think, oh, well, I'm just going to be back later, so what's the big deal if I tell anyone?
Well, before you go, you should always, number one, have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you type in on Google, LA Sheriff Hiking Plan, the very first thing that comes up is a 2-page document that we designed specifically to help us find someone should they get lost. Hmm. And this is a 2-page document that you could give to a loved one or family member. The other thing, besides having a plan, tell someone the plan and stick to the plan. It's not going to do any good if you change your mind halfway up the mountain. You're going to go hike somewhere else after you've already told someone you're going to go hike some other place.
So what basic things do you suggest people carry with them? We got the cell phone possibly. Water would be another one that I would imagine. But what are some other things maybe that they should have with them at all times?
Well, there is the tent essentials. Mm-hmm. And basically that's designed for, you know, keeping yourself warm, being able to signal a helicopter. Basically, you should plan for the worst and just assume you may have to be out there overnight, which means taking some type of a jacket, take enough food. I mean, there's millions of energy bars out there, yeah, you know, that could, you know, sustain you overnight. But the most important thing to take is a friend.
As a friend, yeah, if you can, if you have one, right? If you have one that's willing to go with you. But here's what I hear from friends of mine that like going hiking and trail running. But Mike, look, I don't hate being encumbered. I don't want to carry a pack and a sweater and water and my cell phone. I want to just be free with nature.
Well, and while I would not recommend that, there's places where you could do that a little more safely than others. You know, local areas like in the Hollywood Hills, Santa Monica Mountains, you know, you could go trail running on trails that are very well established and well trafficked, so that you would not be out, you know, in the middle of nowhere necessarily.
All right, Mike. So say I've tried to do everything right, but still I got lost. I'm lost. I have no idea where to go, how to get back to my car or get back to wherever I want to be. What should I do?
Well, the good news is I tell people all the time, if you're going to get lost, do it in Los Angeles County.
Okay.
Because in Los Angeles County, you're going to have rescue teams racing to find you. You're going to have the Sheriff's Air Rescue 5 coming to look for you. You're going to have the Forest Service, and you're probably going to have the fire department. So the best thing to do is stay put. Creating some type of a shelter to, you know, keep you warm, because hypothermia is the number one thing that's going to immediately impact you. And then also, once you've done those things, make yourself visible from the air, whether that's bright clothing or whether that's, you know, taking some tree limbs and forming some kind of letters in the trail. Anything that is not naturally occurring will pop out to an air crew that's looking for you.
That was Mike Loom discussing tips for staying safe on mountain trails. He's an expert in trail safety and the search and rescue group leader for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. All right, we're ending today's show on a musical note. That is K-pop sensation BTS. The band announced dates for its 2019 world tour today and the kickoff right here in LA at the Rose Bowl May 4th. BTS has risen to international stardom since the band started in 2013. They're known for their elaborate music videos and dance routines, as well as chart-topping hits like the one we're listening to now called Fake Love. Now, earlier this month, BTS became the first K-pop group to present an award at the Grammys. When the band came to Los Angeles last September, they sold out all four shows at Staples Center. For those looking to score tickets this time, mark your calendars and prepare to act quickly. They go on sale March 1st. All right, Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.